All right, welcome to The Truth Is So Boring here on WIOX Community Radio, 91.3 FM in the Central Catskills region. My name is Scott, my pronouns are he, him.
My name is Owen, mine are he, him as well.
And today we have a whole variety of topics to talk about while we take another couple of weeks to before we get back to our A Chemical Hunger series. Do you want to take the first story, Owen?
Yeah. So, great news for the BCTGM workers at the Kellogg's ready-to-eat manufactory. Members of the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union, who work at Kellogg's in Battle Creek, Michigan, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Omaha, Nebraska, and Memphis, Tennessee, have all voted to accept the recommended collective bargaining agreement. Approval of the contract ends BCTGM's strike against Kellogg's, which began on October 5th, 2021. So that means the skilled workers will be going back to the plants. Managers won't be running all of the food making stuff, and hopefully we'll be seeing less plastic in our Cheez-Its.
I feel like you're probably referencing a couple stories there that I didn't pick up on. I did want to say that I don't think that the workers won every concession that they wanted. They did win the most important key concession, which was preventing the they got rid of the two-tiered worker system, which helps them with future bargaining deals. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen for a while because I think it's a 5-year contract. But there are also some unfortunate losses in that with regards to working conditions and pay.
Dang it.
Yeah. There's information on that out there. Maybe I can drop some resources in the notes.
What a helpful illustration of the 10% rule of politics. You always get 10% of what you ask for.
That's a reference to an excellent skit in the most recent, well, not the most recent Serious or Wrong episode. They just dropped a new one, like, yesterday. In other news, Greenland bans fossil fuel exploration. Greenland, this comes from, what is this? Greenland has announced it permanently is halting all new oil and gas exploration in the country. This is coming from OptimistDaily.com. So bear in mind that it's a bit of an optimistic take. Despite the recent discovery of potentially significant oil reserves off the island's east coast, the country's government says the costs for our planet far outweigh any potential financial gains. The future does not lie in oil. The future belongs to renewable energy, and in that respect, we have much more to gain.
In addition to banning oil and gas exploration, the country has also introduced legislation to halt the investigation, exploration, and extraction of uranium, which, side note, I think that might not be the smartest goal.
That's something that I'm open to debating.
It's a hot debate on the left whether or not nuclear.
And I'm genuinely undecided on it. I think that it's something that I would like to hear further debate on.
Hopefully, Greenland's actions will inspire other countries to follow suit and accelerate their divestment from fossil fuels, says OptimistDaily.com.
Another thing that made this seem a little less optimistic to me was pointing out in the comments on this that Greenland's ice sheets are where a lot of the natural gas research would be occurring, and since those are melting, I don't think it's going to make a ton of difference whether we extract that particular stuff or not, although that doesn't really apply to the oil stuff. So,
the extraction
bit of good news, bit of bad news.
The extraction process itself isn't exactly the most environmentally friendly.
Oh, that's a good point.
Like, you're not just taking things out, you're also putting things in to move things around, and, you know, a disaster doesn't have to be, oh, the oil leaked where it wasn't supposed to. It could be, oh, the rig broke. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're spilling a bunch of, like, some other chemical that's used for something tangential or whatever. You know, I mean, like, there's a lot. I feel like the risk of the natural gas escaping into the atmosphere from melting ice sheets is a lot more quantifiable and predictable than the potential risks from just externalities caused by mining operations. Anyway.
Very interesting points. Thank you, Owen. I think our next story comes in the form of a clip from Work Stoppages, episode 84, which is a year in review. They did a brief segment on OSHA. Do you have that clip lined up, Owen?
Yep.
So we've gone over many, many different cases of why OSHA, the organization designed to make dangerous workplace conditions much safer, has done very little to actually accomplish that task. In February, we discussed a liquid nitrogen leak at a food processing plant in Georgia where 6 workers were killed. OSHA had previously investigated complaints of several types of hazardous conditions at this plant, or at least the plants owned by the parent company, Foundation Food Group. But they had only issued fines of $12,000 or less, basically meaning that people's lives are really not worth that much.
Yeah. And so the previous incidents they'd been fined for were minor accidents, like a guy's hand getting sucked into a meat grinder and losing several fingers. And
totally
like
minor.
Other incidences of people being maimed where the company was only fined in the single digit thousands of dollars. And even in the case of this, where 6 people lost their lives because of the negligence of this company and the various contractors involved, OSHA still only fined the company $600,000 and the contractors that were involved in the line's installation combined $400,000. So, like, to put this in perspective, like, I know $600,000 seems like, maybe it seems like a lot of money, depending on if you've, you know, followed our show for this.
Right.
But, like, Foundation Food Group makes over $200 million a year. So a $600,000 fine to them is a rounding error. Like, yeah. What that's not going to force them to change anything. They have no material incentive to change anything about what they're doing. And we've seen this exact same sort of thing all throughout the time we've been doing the show. Like, one thing that has become monumentally clear over the last 2 years is that despite OSHA supposedly protecting us against dangerous working conditions, has no intention of doing anything about COVID. Like, you know, One of the biggest workplace dangers anybody faces right now is, you know, this infectious disease that we have very specific, you know, measures that can be taken to keep people safe against. But like, over the first 7 months of the pandemic, we learned that OSHA only fined businesses across the entire country a total of $1 million. And that was across 85 companies. So I believe it averaged out to about $14,000 a company for fines related to, you know, COVID workplace protection.
It's not even a slap on the wrist. It's like a suggestion that I might slap you on the wrist.
Yeah. And like, we reported on an especially egregious case of this in June when we learned about a case in Wisconsin where there was a green bean facility owned by the company Seneca Farms that primarily relies on migrant labor. And during the height of, I mean, I keep using this phrase during the height of the pandemic, but I think during the height of the pandemic is right now. So
during
it's probably
the last height of the pandemic.
Yeah, during a previous surge in 2020, like they were keeping workers in cramped barracks type housing. They were not providing testing. They were not doing any contact tracing. They were not informing workers when other members of their work team tested positive. And then when folks did test positive, they just packed people onto full buses and sent them back to, you know, whichever country they had migrated here from on their work visa. And as a result, at least 11 workers died at this facility to produce green beans. And the company was fined less than $5,000, $4,900 for the deaths of 11 migrant workers. So, yeah, like we know 11 people died from that case. But considering the fact that they were almost intentionally.
I this made me so mad. Like, I remember hearing a long time ago, people saying that somebody had figured out like how much, like it was, like on average, how much like a human life cost to, I guess, the economy, whenever it was, you know, for like I guess insurance purposes and whatnot. And I always thought that was really grim, but to see
how the market determines that?
Well, not just that, but like just the fact that at some point someone decided it was okay to value 11 people's lives at $4,900. It's just, it makes me sick.
I mean, to put a dollar value on life, period.
Yeah.
But of yeah, course. It's just like the lower it is, the worse and of a disgrace it is.
And this is something that I think is one of the most valuable parts of our society. This is where we get our food. This is these are the people that feed us, mm-hmm. and this is how we treat them?
Mm-hmm.
Go on.
Well, okay, a lot of the people that feed us, undocumented migrant workers, mm-hmm. get paid way less than minimum wage, don't get breaks.
Like, that's who these people are. These are migrant agricultural workers who got... You want to go on with the clip?
Yeah.
Turning it into a super spreader event, I'm sure the death toll was actually quite a bit higher. And speaking of super spreaders, we also saw a case in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where Smithfield, who is, you know, one of the biggest pork processors in the world, where they were actually bragging about the fact that half of their workforce got COVID because they were claiming it was proof that their testing program was good, that they knew about that.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
And at least four of their workers died. And again, OSHA only fined the company $13,000. And part of the punishment was the company had to put together a panel to recommend new safety guidelines. But the company got to pick who was on the panel. So, like, it's a completely fake punishment. The workers had no involvement whatsoever in these changes.
Yeah. And then, as you know, were to point out that, you know, the Democrats have done nearly nothing to actually do anything about this. I mean, this goes back to when Joe Biden had originally campaigned on putting strong OSHA guidelines to actually protect workers from COVID, and then later didn't do that and only put in the precautions for healthcare workers, which it's good to protect healthcare workers, but all workers need protection so that healthcare workers can be protected.
Yes.
I mean, if the healthcare industry is being overrun by people with COVID, that does not actually make things safer for the healthcare workers. And I think I don't have the details on what Joe Biden said recently, but basically he's committing to doing nothing. And I don't know. Our predictions are that we're going to see a lot of Republican wins in the next election cycle for sure.
Well, and, you know, it doesn't even matter if Republicans or Democrats win because they never help contribute more money to or more stringent regulation by bodies like OSHA or FEMA or basically anything that's like there's something wrong. Let's fix it.
I think it's more to the point that they claim to be the people who care or do something, and then they don't, and then they lose, and they're like, why do we lose?
Well, and they blame people like us, as, you know, the left is getting people not to vote for us just because we didn't do any of the things we said we would do.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, probably the most... maybe the most egregious example, there's a lot of egregious examples of, like... just the horrific working conditions that the working class faces here in this country and how little protection any of us really have on the job site was the story from just a couple of weeks ago that was one of the most difficult stories that we've talked about all year, which was the folks who were killed during that tornado system that went through a bunch of states and specifically destroyed an Amazon warehouse in Illinois and a candle factory in Kentucky, which has now resulted in 15 worker deaths because one worker has died actually since our reporting, when these workers at these facilities were not allowed to leave during a tornado because they were told if they did, they would be fired. And of course, you know, there's been a letter sent with concerns by I think members of the National Progressive Caucus about the fact that Amazon and these other places didn't actually have, you know, safety plans. None of the companies ran tornado drills or even had shelters. And to any regular person, it is clear that the blood of these workers is directly on the hands of these companies and they should be held accountable and brought to justice for these deaths that did not have to happen. But I mean,
Yeah, leave it to the Marxist-Leninists to talk about bringing justice and like it really irked me listening to this segment, like that I just don't see any way that you could make up for such an injustice. Like it's the injustice has happened and trying to bring justice, just can we just make this not happen?
Yeah, I mean, like you're not there's a discussion you wanted to have that we didn't have time to really fully explore yet about what justice is and like how the rhetoric of justice is used to just, you know, exact punishment on people and that may or may not actually deserve it, and et cetera, et cetera. And like, yeah, like whether it's even a possible thing. Like, this is a philosophical discussion that certainly deserves to be had and shouldn't just be taken for granted the way it generally is.
I get that, like, what this guy was probably trying to say, what Dan was probably trying to say was that, like, he wanted to see something happen which would discourage this sort of behavior in the future. And I just feel like the use of that rhetoric is less than ideal. In the circumstances.
With all the examples we just described, I can't see OSHA doing anything. And I mean, against a company like Amazon, they could fine them $20 million and it wouldn't do anything.
I think one detail in the Amazon story that like also really highlights how especially egregious that particular one is that though there were 90 people who, as of December 15th, died in the tornadoes, 80 of them were in Kentucky, which meant that 10 people in other states, probably Illinois, died, meaning that over half of the deaths from the tornado were because of Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a really stark example of how, like, we cannot rely on these state bodies under capitalism to protect us or enforce any sort of workers' protections. We still got to, you know.
I just wanted to make one more point. The candle workers, I couldn't believe they didn't mention this. The candle workers, the candle factory workers.
They did at the start, but go on.
They were prisoners. They were slaves. They weren't just workers. They were prison labor. And
how does that figure? They said that they were told they would be fired if they left.
That was the Amazon workers. They must have missed the detail about the candle factory. I read this elsewhere. And I mean, of course, correct me if I'm wrong. Tweet me at @dscottboggs. You're gonna look it up.
You know it.
But just like the idea that they just like weren't allowed to leave. It wasn't like, oh, you'll be fired. It was like, oh, you know, like there's a guard saying you can't. That's really messed up.
Yeah.
Do you want to finish the clip out while you look that up?
Yeah. Let's not bore people with me going. Okay.
He's under capitalism. To protect us or enforce any sort of workers' protections. We still got to, you know, get out there and do mass struggle and fight for reforms. But we have to understand that it's ultimately workers' organizations like unions, like, you know, mass parties, like socialist parties and organizations like that, mutual aid groups and, you know, societies like that, that are it's working class organizations that are really the only thing that are ever going to be able to enforce protections for workers, because the capitalist state being run by the capitalists doesn't really care and only puts into place such measures that we, you know, make them do through mass struggle.
Right. And they, you know, it's been proven time and time again, if you pay attention to actions and results, that they don't care, but they'll tell you they care. A lot of these companies don't even try to hide it. Like, there are plenty of sickly libertarian companies run by, like, weird Scrooge McDucks who would just shoot you in the face for a dollar and not think twice. But then,
like Black Rifle Coffee.
Sure, Black Rifle Coffee or, you know, Walmart or whatever. But progressive companies, quote unquote, such as No Evil Foods, so-called Colectivo, Starbucks, Voodoo Donuts, and the New York Times, which it's so funny to me that people still call the New York Times progressive or whatever.
Okay, so we did look it up, and it's one of those yes and no things.
Yeah, we were both right.
Some of the workers were prison workers.
At least seven of them were from Graves County Jail,
but not all of them.
More than 100 other employees were just regular employees.
And I knew that, and I feel like I just didn't say it right. So thank you for clarifying that.
I mean, it matters. It all matters, you know? It not just being, like, having correct info, but, like, you know, all the details. Like, prison labor being legalized slavery is something that I feel like we don't talk about enough, even though I bring it up at every chance I get.
Well, that's what I was doing.
Yeah, and so is the whole, if you were faced with losing your job or maybe dying in a warehouse in a situation where you have to work to survive, I mean, that's not much of a choice.
No. Anyway, we have some further information, a new story. This is moving on from OSHA. I couldn't believe how obscure this was when I saw it. It was just some random HR benefits director made a post on Reddit that I stumbled across. It only has like 4 upvotes and 3 comments after weeks. And incredible serendipity that I stumbled across this. Friends, first a little background. I was an HR benefits director for a company in the U.S. for over 5 years. We had facilities in 3 states when I worked there. Within a month of starting as the director, I already hated the health insurance and recognized that the scam was worse than I imagined. The horrors only increased as I learned more, until the fateful year I learned and we switched to a self-funded healthcare plan.
Before we talk about self-funded plans, let's cover what a fully funded plan is so that we know exactly what the heck we're talking about here. A fully funded plan is exactly what you think is happening at your company. Your company signs up with one of the major insurance carriers, gives them certain details about their employees, and the carriers then give them a list of premium payments for benefit levels. So the company can pick from a bunch of different plans with different benefit levels and costs to the company. Then the company picks how much of that cost that they will have the employees pay. You sign up for the plan level you want with what other family members you want covered. It comes out of your paycheck, and you start dealing with the insurance company for all your health needs. This was the type of stuff that was offered at all of the traditional jobs I've ever held.
Mm-hmm. When you go to the doctor's office, that claim gets sent to the insurance company. Each month, the company gets a bill that shows which employees are on the plans at what rate, and that's it. Once you hit a certain number of covered bodies on the plan, you also start getting information about what kinds of things people are doing. People are going to the doctors for. For instance, you might find you might get a report that shows that 20% of your employees are making claims that might indicate they are pre-diabetic. It doesn't say which employees
because
they are.
HIPAA.
Huh?
Because HIPAA.
Oh yeah. It doesn't say which employees, and also they don't give that information until you have a lot of people covered, so not to expose through just percentages.
So that they can't infer from data, you know. Because like, you can de-anonymize data if it's not properly anonymized in the first place.
Yeah, with a small enough data set, it's pretty simple.
They suggest that you then use this information to drive health incentives to your employees. The insurance company might even offer a discount if you offer a health drive event. From talking to people, this is what everyone thinks is happening at their company, and for fully funded insurance plans, they are mostly right.
However, there's also something called a self-funded insurance plan.
Before we get into this, know that these are complicated. We can easily talk about this person's experience, but not all self-funded plans are exactly the same. The basic concept is the same, which is what we're here to talk about.
In a self-funded plan, instead of hiring a carrier to handle your insurance claims, the company itself becomes an insurance company. This means that the company is cutting out the insurance company to save on some money. The company will then buy other insurances in case the claims balloon too quickly, but the point of self-funded is that the company takes on more of the risk of health insurance. This saves the company money, which they then pass on to the employees, the shareholders. The company still makes the same looking benefit plans that you see in full funded. They also sign on with the same hospital systems and networks. So you might have Medical Mutual fully funded or Medical Mutual self-funded and can see the same network either way.
So it sounds like everything above is the same, except that detail of the company being the insurance company. Where is the horror? I'm over here like I know what the horror is. I haven't even read this all from top to bottom yet, and I can see where
it's going.
Yeah. I'm going to quote from the wiki article above in the prevalence section. Perhaps the biggest advantage of self-funded plans is transparency of claims data. Self-funded employers who contract a TPA receive a monthly report detailing medical claims and pharmacy costs. Knowing this information becomes instrumental in controlling costs by shifting buying patterns. Other advantages include plan flexibility, access to national PPO networks, and financial savings. So actually, I think this is what we had at the places I used to work at, not the fully funded plans. Hmm. So basically, what this means is if your company is also your insurance provider...
Well, they tell us what that means.
Well, okay.
Let me tell you in simple terms what that means.
Simpler terms than I could manage, I guess.
It means... Well, I just didn't want to repeat the same information twice. It means that every week in my plan, I got an Excel sheet emailed to me that showed me employee name, date of claim, family member who claim was for, where the claim was filed, what the service or prescription it was for, and how much it cost.
I want you to think about that. For every self-funded plan, someone connected directly to the company is getting information about your claims, what medicine you're getting, what services you're getting. The self-funded administrator at your company knows you or your spouse are pregnant before you probably told your family, for example.
Oh, that's gross.
Or, like, imagine, like, being in my situation as a trans person, starting to go on HRT before telling the company that you're trans, because a lot of people are stealth.
Oh, man.
Can you just imagine what kind of... Or, okay, what if you're a gay person and you start going on PrEP for HIV prevention?
That's,
Or I mean, so what my brain originally jumped to, and then I'm happy to go back to reading in just a second, but I really want
to... I also want to point to the clock.
I think we're doing great on time. It's 9:32 a.m. here. It's chilly.
It's actually 9:29. Your clock is off.
Oh, yeah. My clock is off. That's right. Okay. Anyway, my brain went immediately to something that I'm going to not use specifics because this is like personal information about other people's health a few years ago that I don't want to like give out specifics on. But people who had like cancer type chronic illnesses or COPD type.
Well, that's exactly.
Illnesses, or environmentally caused obesity, mm-hmm. and those people who and a couple of people who had like traumatic, like instantaneous issues, like stroke or whatever. I'm just saying, like shifting buying practices equals. Oh, we're gonna drop the part that covers your cancer treatment. Now you have to pay out of pocket.
Yes. Now, you must be thinking, well, yes, but in a fully funded plan, the insurance company knows that also. That is true, but the insurance company isn't sitting two cubicles over from HR and hearing that you had another disciplinary action. The insurance company probably isn't thinking, well, they are in that gray area of if we should let them go or not, and I just saw that their kid is starting treatment for leukemia, which is going to increase our premiums by 10%. Are you seeing the horror yet? I will just throw out there that there are laws to protect you from this. HIPAA and ADA are two big ones, but you know how that goes. On a personal note, I hated knowing this. I hated knowing what I saw and recused myself from disciplinary discussions because of this. Some companies will tell you they have a third-party administrator to review and see this data so that there's no chance of that happening. But if you read articles about self-funded, it still comes down to the company has liability to manage the claims, and which means somehow it can know it all if they want.
Which means someone can know it all if they want.
Yeah. Another horror to mention is that the company controls the benefits to all levels. So they could see employees buying X amount of Y medication, even though there is a generic available. They can change the plan to make the medication not be insured and push everything to generic. That is what it above means when it says shifting buying patterns. So another example I would cite is if you worked for a company where you might have people with certain ideologies, certain bigoted ideologies.
What did you say?
And making certain categories of stuff more expensive,
or say
HRT, for example.
Or excluding entirely reproductive health care services.
Yeah, I could see that being a thing too.
Don't get me started on mental health or drugs that are so specific to make that they are actually different in their generic and brand name forms. And like I've heard multiple accounts of people like being pushed to generics and like having, you know, really bad issues from that because it's not mm-hmm. actually the same.
The article wraps up by saying that basically if your company has over 500 employees, you probably have a self-funded plan and that number is shrinking every year. Moving right along into another topic here, for-profit companies are trying to privatize libraries.
Oh, no.
This is from a Truth Out article by Caleb Nichols.
So this is a... We're starting at the beginning here, and this is a quote. I feel
this
like
this is an excerpt from the article.
Yes, but in the article, what I'm saying is a quote.
Oh, yes. It is kind of a cold open in the article.
Yeah. In fact, why don't I do the talking part and you do the narrating part?
Okay.
This library is full of losers.
An HR person said to me as I signed my letter of resignation from my public library job.
A bunch of losers who just take, take, take. Good for you, moving on up in the world.
I was truly shocked by her disdain for my coworkers. The HR person approved of my resignation because I was leaving an assistant position to take a professional one at another library, joining the ranks of other degreed librarians after graduating from library school.
But her comment dripped with scorn towards all the people who simply showed up to work each day, collecting their modest paychecks and serving the public. Indeed, her comment reflected a more widespread attitude that I found among administrators, members of the professional managerial class, within the public sector. Many are capitalist groupies who see unionized employees working for the government as leeches. This anti-worker sentiment within the administrative ranks of many public libraries has made it easier for one of the most nefarious grifts in the United States economic system to take hold, the public-private partnership, a Reagan-era arrangement in which private industry partners with the public sector, claiming to be able to deliver more for less in service to the public. Did someone say externalities?
Yeah. Skipping ahead to a little further in the article, he goes on. Library Systems and Services is a for-profit private company that has been quietly infiltrating public libraries since 1997, when it successfully negotiated a contract to privatize the county library system in Riverside County, California. In the 90s and through the first decade of the 2000s, LS&S operated using a business model that will be familiar to anyone who follows local government issues in the U.S. A private company descends on a municipal or county government that is in financially poor shape and offers to take over or outsource management of a public service, like a library, for a fraction of the cost. The business model changed slightly, but alarmingly, about a decade ago.
In 2010, LS&S made headlines by securing contracts to privatize public libraries in affluent, economically healthy municipalities, rather than in struggling, economically marginalized communities. Flexing into a new type of market, the sky is apparently the limit for LS&S, which, according to its own website, has shockingly morphed into, quote, the third largest library system in the United States, end quote. If this is true, LS&S is a major threat to one of our most beloved, democratic, and socialistic institutions. Operating unchecked, LS&S stands to make enormous profits by destroying decent-paying, unionized jobs, deprofessionalizing an already struggling profession, and reducing library services to anti-human, vertically integrated content silos that do not reflect the values of local communities, all while remaining completely unaccountable to taxpayers.
How does LS and Library Systems and Services manage to cut costs while operating services? On the backs of workers, of course.
When companies like LS&S privatize public goods, old contracts and unions are thrown out. Workers, even professional managerial class workers like degreed librarians, cease earning annual salaries, solid benefits, and government-backed pensions, and are instead given comparably lower hourly wages, private retirement accounts, and have no collective bargaining power or ability to file grievances. LS&S claims to be a public good by saving communities taxpayer money, but it is actually destroying good-paying, union-backed jobs and paving the way for more private takeovers of public goods.
And for some people associated with the company, this almost appears to be a vendetta against working people. Consider the comments of Library Systems and Services founder and former CEO Frank Pezanite. Pezanite.
I can't. I want to give it, pronounce in Italian. I'm sorry.
I want to give it like the Italian double Z. Pet sanity.
Like, yeah, that sounds pet sanity. That sounds like an app.
Yeah, it sounds like something they would come up with in Silicon Valley. As reported in the New York Times, Pitsanity said that a lot of libraries are atrocious. Their policies are actually about job security. You can go to a library for 35 years and never have to do anything, and then have retirement. Sounds an awful lot like most CEOs, hedge fund billionaires, and other capitalists who make trillions in profit off the labor of workers to all of us.
Additionally, as a private company, Library Sales and Services is able to circumvent... That is what it is, right?
Mm-hmm. Library Systems and Services.
is able to circumvent transparency laws that taxpayer-funded governments are required to follow. In a nutshell, taxpayers fund LSNS-managed libraries, but have no ability to find out how LSNS operates. Freedom of Information Act?
Nope.
Doesn't apply to private companies. Public accountability? An interesting question. Normally, if a company does something you don't like, you can boycott it. But if people boycotted a public library? Well, then I suppose local governments would have good measurable data to use to justify further slashing budgets. LSNS is completely unaccountable, and we have no way of knowing how they conduct themselves internally, even as they manage a taxpayer-funded service.
And there is cause for concern in the way LSNS conducts itself, beyond just the alarming idea that one of the most beloved institutions in American life is under serious threat of quiet privatization. An activist engaged in public library advocacy told me, that is Chris, what's his name again?
Hedges?
No, that's a different guy.
Then I don't know.
I'm scrolling up in the notes. Nichols, Chris Nichols, Caleb Nichols.
This is written. Okay, go on.
Caleb Nichols in Truth Out. I'm sorry. Could you resume reading? I lost my place.
An activist engaged in public library advocacy told me that a dozen of the vendors that public libraries use to purchase books in bulk are actually owned by library sales and services.
Systems and services.
Excuse me. So many libraries are paying library systems and services already and don't even know it. I haven't been able to independently confirm this claim, but it is something that investigative journalists could look into. If it's true, his is even more sinister than it appears on the surface. This sort of vertical integration could set an extremely dangerous precedent that further erodes the public's ability to control the information it consumes, not to mention what types of information resources are purchased by its tax dollars.
Furthermore, it's worth taking note of who actually owns library systems and services. Boston-based private equity firm Islington Capital Partners. I've heard the name, haven't you?
Yeah, me too. Islington is familiar.
Whose co-founder, Paul Spinelli, worked for Bain Capital during Mitt Romney's tenure at the infamous firm. So, just let that sink in. The same arch-villains, known for siphoning taxpayer-funded government bailout money into their own pockets, now have majority control over a private company that manages 80 public library systems in the U.S., and which loudly and proudly claims to be the third largest library system in the U.S. Even LSNS's current CEO is a veteran grifter who previously worked for the Scantron Corporation, a company whose business model is arguably responsible for the anti-human practice of standardized testing across the education spectrum, and definitely a topic that we should dive into at some point. Library systems and services methods are not unique, but that doesn't make them any less atrocious. It claims to take failing or shoddy public institutions and miraculously turn them around through its superior understanding of how things should be run. The same old of private interests trying to edge out public goods. Think of Louis DeJoy and his seemingly intentional mismanagement of the U.S. Postal Service. While library systems and services hasn't quite been as disastrous for public libraries, it represents a similar threat to the public interest, corporate takeover of public spaces. I would say also enclosure of the commons. If library systems and services can demonstrate that it is able to work enough corporate magic on enough libraries, then conservatives from, you know, libertarian, Democrats, Republican, it doesn't matter, they could be armed with over 20 years of corporate engineered data to justify further privatization of public spaces. What's clear is that the LSNS is not performing any actual miracles. It is destroying unionized jobs, denigrating and demoralizing workers, and contributing to the myth that unionized public sector workers are lazy, inefficient, and unworthy of the benefits that they receive.
Come along, catch a heifer lump. Sit with me on a muddy clump. We'll sing a song of days gone by. Run along now, don't be glum. Get you gone now, have some fun. Don't be long, for the end is nigh. Don't let moments pass along and waste before your eyes. March with me in the borough grove. Come with me in the slidey toes, and never ask us why. Come, 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 come along now. Run away from the humdrum. We'll go to a place that is safe from greed, anger, and boredom. We'll dance and sing till sundown, and feast with abandon. We'll sleep when the morning comes, and we'll rise by the sound of the bird song. Slows down and the sunbeams
things fade away. Keeping time by a pendulum as the fabric starts to fray. There's no such thing as time to kill, nor time to throw.
All right, I think that just about does it for this week's edition of The Truth is So Boring for Thursday, January 6th. It's 9:43, a little early to be wrapping up, but I heard a segment of an audiobook that I'm reading, The Dawn of Everything by David Graeber and David Wingrow.
Man,
it's so good, and I took the opportunity to cut an excerpt from it, a little bit of a tease. This is from the end of chapter 4, and if you feel like it might sound like it's jumping to some conclusions, the rest of chapter 4 before it kind of fills in those gaps. So I definitely recommend picking it up a copy. We will be back in 2 weeks for another episode of The Truth is So Boring, where we will be resuming our series on a chemical hunger, the obesity epidemic,
and mysteries.
Yeah, and we will be back also tomorrow at 2 p.m. for Cat's Chill music program. We encourage you to visit our website, thetruthissoboring.org, where our back catalog is available, and this episode will be available sometime next week. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. Have a great morning.
Yep.
In which we finally return to the question of property and inquire as to its relation to the sacred. All this means that, of the many distinct cultural universes beginning to take shape across the world in the early Holocene, most were likely centered on environments of abundance rather than scarcity, more like the Calusas than the Kungs. Does this also mean they were likely to have similar political arrangements to the Calusa? Here, some caution is in order. That the Calusa managed to maintain a sufficient economic surplus to support what looks to us like a miniature kingdom does not mean such an outcome is inevitable as soon as a society is capable of stockpiling a sufficient quantity of fish. After all, the Calusa were seafaring people. They would have undoubtedly been familiar with kingdoms ruled by divine monarchs like the Great Sun of the Natchez in nearby Louisiana, and, likely as not, the empires of Central America. It's possible they were simply imitating more powerful neighbors, or maybe they were just odd. Finally, we don't really know how much power even a divine king like Carlos really had. Here, it's useful to consider the Natchez themselves, an agricultural group, much better documented than the Calusa, and with a spectacular and purportedly absolute monarch of their own. The Natchez son, as the monarch was known, inhabited a village in which he appeared to wield unlimited power. His every movement was greeted by elaborate rituals of deference, bowing and scraping. He could order arbitrary executions, help himself to any of his subjects' possessions, do pretty much anything he liked. Still, this power was strictly limited by his own physical presence, which in turn was largely confined to the royal village itself. Most Natchez did not live in the royal village. Indeed, most tended to avoid the place for obvious reasons. Outside it, royal representatives were treated no more seriously than Montagne Nascaupi chiefs. If subjects weren't inclined to obey these representatives' orders, they simply laughed at them. In other words, while the court of the Natchez Sun was not pure empty theatre, those executed by the Great Sun were most definitely dead, neither was it the court of Suleiman the Magnificent or Aurangzeb. It seems to have been something almost precisely in between. Was Calusa kingship a similar arrangement? Spanish observers clearly didn't think so. They regarded it as a more or less absolute monarchy. But since typically half the point of such deadly theatrics is to impress outsiders, that tells us very little in itself. What have we learned so far? Most obviously, that we can now put a final nail in the coffin of the prevailing view that human beings lived more or less like Kalahari bushmen until the invention of agriculture sent everything askew. Even were it possible to write off Pleistocene mammoth hunters as some kind of strange anomaly, the same clearly cannot be said for the period that immediately followed the glacier's retreat, when dozens of new societies began to form along resource-rich coasts, estuaries and river valleys, gathering in large and often permanent settlements, creating entirely new industries, building monuments according to mathematical principles, developing regional cuisines, and so on. We have also learned that at least some of these societies developed a material infrastructure capable of supporting royal courts and standing armies, even though we have, as yet, no clear evidence that they actually did so. To construct the earthworks at Poverty Point, for instance, must have taken enormous amounts of human labour and a strict regime of carefully planned out work, but we still have little idea how that labour was organised. Japanese archaeologists, surveying thousands of years' worth of Jomon sites, have discovered all sorts of treasures, but they are yet to find indisputable evidence that those treasures were monopolised by any sort of aristocracy or ruling elite. We cannot possibly know exactly which forms of ownership existed in these societies. What we can suggest, and there's plenty of evidence to support it, is that all the places in question, Poverty Point, Sanai Maruyama, the Castelli Giant's Church in Finland, or indeed the earlier resting places of Upper Paleolithic grandees, were in some sense sacred places. This might not seem like saying very much, but it's important. It tells us a lot more about the origins of private property than is generally assumed. In rounding off this discussion, we will try to explain why. Let's turn again to the anthropologist James Woodburn, and a less well-known insight from his work on immediate return hunter-gatherers. Even among those forager groups famous for their assertive egalitarianism, he notes, there was one striking exception to the rule that no adult should ever presume to give direct orders to another, and that individuals should not lay private claim to property. This exception came in the sphere of ritual, of the sacred. In Hadza religion, and the religions of many pygmy groups, initiation into male and sometimes female cults forms the basis of exclusive claims to ownership, usually of ritual privileges, that stand in absolute contrast to the minimization of exclusive property rights in everyday secular life. These various forms of ritual and intellectual property, Woodburn observed, are generally protected by secrecy, by deception, and often by the threat of violence. Here, Woodburn cites the sacred trumpets that initiated males of certain pygmy groups keep hidden in secret places in the forest. Not only are women and children not supposed to know about such sacred treasures, should any follow the men to spy on them, they would be attacked or even raped. Strikingly similar practices involving sacred trumpets, sacred flutes, or other fairly obvious phallic symbols are commonplace in certain contemporary societies of Papua New Guinea and Amazonia. Very often, there is a complex game of secrets whereby the instruments are periodically taken out of their hiding places and men pretend they are the voices of spirits, or use them as part of costumed masquerades in which they impersonate spirits to terrify women and children. Now, these sacred items are, in many cases, the only important and exclusive forms of property that exist in societies where personal autonomy is taken to be a paramount value, or what we may simply call free societies. It's not just relations of command that are strictly confined to sacred contexts, or even occasions where humans impersonate spirits. So too is absolute, or what we would today refer to as private, property. In such societies, there turns out to be a profound formal similarity between the notion of private property and the notion of the sacred. Both are essentially structures of exclusion. Much of this is implicit, if never clearly stated or developed, in Emil Durkheim's classic definition of the sacred as that which is set apart, removed from the world and placed on a pedestal, at sometimes literally and at other times figuratively, because of its imperceptible connection with a higher force or being. Durkheim argued that the clearest expression of the sacred was the Polynesian term taboo, meaning not to be touched. But when we speak of absolute private property, are we not talking about something very similar, almost identical fact in its underlying logic and social effects? As British legal theorists like to put it, individual property rights are held, notionally at least, against the whole world. If you own a car, you have the right to prevent anyone in the entire world from entering or using it. If you think about it, this is the only right you have in your car that's really absolute. Almost anything else you can do with a car is strictly regulated, where and how you can drive it, park it, and so forth. But you can keep absolutely anyone else in the world from getting inside it. In this case, the object is set apart, fenced about by invisible or visible barriers, not because it is tied to some supernatural being, but because it's sacred to a specific living human individual. In other respects, the logic is much the same. To recognize the close parallels between private property and notions of the sacred is also to recognize what is so historically odd about European social thought, which is that, quite unlike free societies, we take this absolute sacred quality in private property as a paradigm for all human rights and freedoms. This is what the political scientist C.B. McPherson meant by possessive individualism. Just as every man's home is his castle, so your right not to be killed, tortured, or arbitrarily imprisoned rests on the idea that you own your own body, just as you own your chattels and possessions, and legally have the right to exclude others from your land or house or car and so on. As we've seen, those who did not share this particular European conception of the sacred could indeed be killed, tortured, or arbitrarily imprisoned. And from Amazonia to Oceania, they often were. For most Native American societies, this kind of attitude was profoundly alien. If it applied anywhere at all, then it was only with regard to sacred objects, or what the anthropologist Robert Lowy termed sacra, when he pointed out long ago that many of the most important forms of indigenous property were immaterial or incorporeal. Magic formulae, stories, medical knowledge, the right to perform a certain dance or stitch a certain pattern on one's mantle. It was often the case that weapons, tools, and even territories used to hunt game were freely shared, but the esoteric powers to safeguard the reproduction of game from one season to the next, or ensure luck in the chase, were individually owned and jealously guarded. Quite often, sacra have both material and immaterial elements, as among the Kwakiutl, where ownership of an heirloom wooden feast dish also conveyed the right to gather berries on a certain stretch of land with which to fill it, which in turn afforded its owner the right to present those berries while singing a certain song at a certain feast, and so forth. Such forms of sacred property are endlessly complex and variable. Among plains societies of North America, for instance, sacred bundles, which normally included not only physical objects but accompanying dances, rituals, and songs, were often the only objects in that society to be treated as private property, not just owned exclusively by individuals, but also inherited, bought, and sold. Often, the true owners of land or other natural resources were said to be gods or spirits. Mortal humans are merely squatters, poachers, or at best, caretakers. People variously adopted a predatory attitude to resources, as with hunters who appropriate what really belongs to the gods, or that of a caretaker, when one is only the owner or master of a village or men's house or stretch of territory, if one is ultimately responsible for maintaining and looking after it. Sometimes these attitudes coexist, as in Amazonia, where the paradigm for ownership or mastery, it's always the same word, involves capturing wild animals and then adopting them as pets. That is, precisely the point where violent appropriation of the natural world turns into nurture or taking care. It is not unusual for ethnographers working with indigenous Amazonian societies to discover that almost everything around them has an owner or could potentially be owned, from lakes and mountains to cultivars, liana groves and animals. As ethnographers also note, such ownership always carries a double meaning of domination and care. To be without an owner is to be exposed, unprotected. In what anthropologists refer to as totemic systems of the kind we discussed for Australia and North America, the responsibility of care takes on a particularly extreme form. Each human clan is said to own a certain species of animal, thus making them the bear clan, elk clan, eagle clan, and so forth. But what this means is precisely that members of that clan cannot hunt, kill, harm, or otherwise consume animals of that species. In fact, they are expected to take part in rituals that promote its existence and make it flourish. What makes the Roman law conception of property, the basis of almost all legal systems today, unique, is that the responsibility to care and share is reduced to a minimum, or even eliminated entirely. In Roman law, there are three basic rights relating to possession. Usus, the right to use. Fructus, the right to enjoy the products of a property, for instance, the fruit of a tree. And abusus, the right to damage or destroy. If one has only the first two rights, this is referred to as usufruct, and is not considered true possession under the law. The defining feature of true legal property, then, is that one has the option of not taking care of it, or even destroying it at will. We are now, finally, approaching a general conclusion about the coming of private property, which can be illustrated by one last and especially striking example, the famous initiation rituals of the Australian Western Desert. Here, adult males of each clan act as guardians or custodians of particular territories. There are certain sacra, known as Churinga or Tsuringa by the Aranda, which are relics of ancestors.
WIOX is supported by the following underwriters.